One of Ralph Waldo Emerson's very good friends was Henry James. Henry James was the father of the famous author, Henry James Jr., and also William James. When William James was born, Emerson happened to be visiting. He asked Emerson if he would bless the child. Emerson went up, blessed William James in his crib. Emerson was a constant visitor at the James house. They had a room in the house. It was a spare bedroom that they referred to as Mr. Emerson's room. Henry James, the father, and Emerson were close friends. They didn't always necessarily see eye to eye, but Henry James really was devoted to Emerson, very, very much devoted to him. He wanted the best for his children, but he wasn't always that good at providing it. He wanted the greatest education that you could get. And so he was constantly trucking the family all over the world in search of the greatest education. So they'd go to Italy to be educated. Then they'd be there a few months. He'd, no, there's better in France. So we go to Paris. No, this stinks. Let's go to Germany. No, William wants to be an artist. There's a great artist in Newport, Rhode Island. Let's go there. So William said he was completely uneducated. William James always felt totally uneducated because he never finished anything. But it did make him a very creative thinker. And in the end, William James decided to study science. He went to what was called the Lawrence School of Science in Harvard. And he ended up with Louis Agassiz, who was the great Swiss scientist, on a trip to Brazil to try and disprove the theory of evolution as laid out by Charles Darwin in Origin of Species. Didn't work. Came back, hated Brazil, hated the trip, didn't want to be a scientist anymore, decided to study medicine, went to the Harvard Medical School, finally got a degree in something, and became a medical doctor. I didn't know this, but at the time, the Harvard Medical School was known as one of the worst medical schools in the world. They said as long as you could pay for the tickets, you could get a degree. The tickets you needed to buy because they didn't actually have tuition. They sold tickets to classes. So you just buy your tickets at the door. And if you went to enough classes, they gave you a degree at the end. So that's what he ended up becoming. That's how he became a doctor. But what he was really became interested in was psychology, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Charles Sanders Peirce was this incredible intellect whose father was Benjamin Peirce, a big Harvard professor. Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, along with a few others, were part of something called the Metaphysical Club. So like Emerson's Transcendental Club, they had their Metaphysical Club. And what they were doing in the Metaphysical Club was discussing big ideas. And one of the big ideas that came out of that came out when Charles Sanders Peirce talked about what he saw as the pragmatic method, which basically meant truth is not something that you determine by looking for origin. In other words, where did the truth come from? How was it constructed from earlier truths? Truth is something that is determined by what happens when one acts on a belief. And if an idea works in action, then it's true. So this is, we're going to go into this in a minute because this is the fundamentals of pragmatism. But this came out in one of their discussions. They were pretty young guys at the time, just kind of hammering it out together in the same way the Transcendentalists were hammering things out in their Transcendentalist Club. John Dewey, who we will talk about in a few minutes, massive intellect, originally was kind of more in the circle of those St. Louis Hegelians. Started as a Hegelian, was educated in Vermont, which was a very Hegelian school. Read William James's first book, which was published in 1889, called The Principles of Psychology. And remember, William James was publishing 6 years before Freud had published anything major, and about 20 years before his major works came out. The Principles of Psychology came out in 1889. Dewey read it, and it completely changed the trajectory of his career. He became a pragmatist at heart. He called his own work instrumentalism, but you'll see it basically means the same thing. George Herbert Mead, George Santayana, Josiah Royce, all students of James at Harvard, all became major American philosophers. George Santayana particularly, you know, really the major American, usually you don't, people don't usually count Emerson as a major American philosopher because he's too religious. So he doesn't really count. James is usually considered the first true American philosopher. The other great ones are George Santayana, John Dewey. I mean, you don't miss them. Charles Peirce is usually included in that group. I did see one book that includes Alfred North Whitehead, who I put up there. It's a bit of a stretch because he was actually English. But he finished his career at Harvard. The last 10 years of his career was at Harvard, so I guess they figured, hey, he's American as far as we're concerned. W.E.B. Du Bois, great African-American thinker and writer, also a student of James's at Harvard, very devoted to James. Gertrude Stein, literary figure, also a student of James's at Harvard, very interested in some of James's work in stream of consciousness. He was really into stream of consciousness. He made that phrase very popular. There was a whole stream of consciousness movement in the arts that kind of came out of his philosophical thinking. Schiller, an English philosopher, he became the fountainhead of the English pragmatic movement. In Italy, there was a guy, I think he's not as famous, I think his name is Papini. He became the Italian, there was a whole circle of Italian pragmatists. James was very in contact with them all. Henry Bergson, for us who are interested in evolutionary enlightenment and integral theory, Henry Bergson is one of the real pillars of integral thinking, the French philosopher. Interesting, lots of admiration between Bergson and William James. Bergson writes the introduction to James's works. James wrote the introduction to one of Bergson's works. Philosophically, they were actually at loggerheads a lot of the time, but they respected each other. A lot of what they had a lot of places where they met and a lot of places where they didn't. But again, like with Emerson, you know, James collected around him quite an incredible group of people. Alfred North Whitehead was once quoted as saying that he felt in the history of humankind, four people made truly original insights: Plato, Aristotle, Leibniz, and William James. So that's a high regard. So this is kind of the time. Now, Emerson was the second, that whole time of that second breath of America. James is a different time. It's after the Civil War, a war that was fought on idealistic ground, but left everybody feeling pretty bad. Enormous amounts of death and destruction. A lot of question whether it was really worth it, whether it really made sense, whether anybody really had the right to force people with that much bloodshed to your way of thinking. So it was even Emerson, who was, he was a big abolitionist, and so most of his comrades had a lot of misgivings. I think when everybody saw the dust settle around the Civil War and the enormous loss of life, it was very devastating. But the other thing, and the thing that really drove James and all of these thinkers, or a lot of them, was the 1859 publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. It started a massive revolution in thinking. I mean, I actually hadn't realized how big a revolution in thinking it was. And it wasn't because of evolution. Evolution was a term, I mean, Emerson was kind of into evolution in a, you know, not in quite as sophisticated a form. Certainly, Hegel was an evolutionary thinker. I mean, people already knew 100 years before that things change. They knew that societies change, and they were creating philosophies about what it would mean to change. But what Charles Darwin did was he changed the way science looked at a problem by proving, quote-unquote, proving or convincing people that evolution, that the evolution of species was true, not by looking backwards for direct empirical evidence, but by statistically examining data and statistically making arguments that said, well, it must have happened this way because this, 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 and this. And it was a real switch. Most people thought it was completely unscientific what he was doing, because science meant finding empirical evidence. So to really prove evolution, you'd have to find some. Find me a piece of evolution, and then I'll believe it. Find me something evolving. Show me it evolving. Then it'll. But this was, no, you just look at the way things are spread out, look at what must have happened. That must be what happened. Statistically, it makes sense. And statistical thinking became a huge part of scientific thinking. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., his father was also a friend of Emerson's, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the doctor, also a big thinker in his own right. His son couldn't stand him. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. became, for 30 years, an American Supreme Court justice, took pragmatic thinking and statistical thinking, and created what we know today as the reasonable man. You know, up until Holmes, that wasn't really something that people thought. So in other words, what would the average person do? And would the, you know, in a given situation, would it be reasonable for someone to do this based on what the average person would do in that circumstance? And if it was reasonable, then you're innocent. If it's not reasonable based on a statistical average, then you're not innocent. This is a completely different way of thinking. You know, before that, you know, they had all these theories. One was basically, if you did it, you were guilty no matter what. You know, you did it, you did it. That was it. The other was, well, only if you really intended for the action to happen were you guilty. You know, but this was different. This was a very different way of thinking. And it was what Charles Sanders Peirce thought, well, this kind of thinking we need to bring into philosophy because we're not using it in philosophy. In philosophy, we're still looking back for metaphysical origins. We're looking back to find the big picture origin and then prove that what we're thinking today is true based on what was happening back then. He said, that's not going to work. We need to start to look at the at what's happening. And if we look at what's happening, and if enough of us are doing it, statistically we'll come to the truth, but the truth is going to be in front of us. We're going to come to it. We're not going to look back and find it in the past.